Hey, we spotted some information posted by the webmaster for Dr. Morgus. Basically, he says because of the devastation upon New Orleans by Hurricane Katrina, the second season of the doctor's televised programs in New Orleans obviously canceled and indefinitely delayed. But there has been no contact with Dr. Morgus, so nobody knows where he is, not even his webmaster. When we come right back, Gordon Michael Scallion, our guest, will talk about some of those predictions through the year 2012, especially these earth changes, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Gordon Michael Scallion, our guest here. Gordon, Edgar Cayce, of course, the great American prophet, the late great American prophet, has always talked about earth changes as well. Your map is different from his, but there are similarities. And I've got to tell you, when you look at this, it is scary because, you know, most of California is gone. Nevada is gone. Utah is gone. Part of Colorado is gone. A great portion of Mexico is gone, sucked up by the ocean. Portions of Oregon. What causes these changes, Gordon?
We kind of touched a little bit on it previously. The mechanism that drives our magnetic field and helps, you know, maintain life on Earth is the rotation of the Earth and the core of the Earth. And they rotate at different speeds. And occasionally they get stuck and then release. And so when that happens, it changes or modifies magnetic fields. And of course, what we're seeing right now is a major reduction and has been consistently for at least a half a century now, maybe more, of the magnetic field declining. And we know from core samples in the past that every time that has happened in the past, there has been a shift of the poles, the magnetic poles. So where north and south can shift, or what can happen is it can shift a few degrees, so that North Pole might move a few degrees. So there's two types of pole shifts. One is where the magnetic field changes, so our compasses would literally just point in a different direction. And the second type is a geophysical shift, where the Earth itself changes its axis position. And that can happen in either where the Earth tumbles in space, or it can happen where the outer crust, lithosphere, if you will, shifts its position relative to the core, which is what I think is occurring now. So I think both things are going on now, magnetic shift and a geophysical shift. The trigger, I believe, is the core of the Earth for this upcoming pole shift that I see. And we already know that we've got changes. The magnetic field is wandering, and it's moving very quickly now, it's heading eastward. So it's well underway, and that is what I believe the mechanism. And, of course, anytime you move that kind of mass internally to the Earth, mm-hmm. you create heat, and that heat has only one place to go, and that's upward.
Will these changes, once they occur, will they be quick? I mean, will we wake up one morning and all this has happened, or will it be a slow, gradual process?
I think it'll be a series of events that will occur. There'll be warning signs that have already occurred, but there'll be more warning signs, and then there'll be an event. Kind of like, you know, the New Orleans event right now, Louisiana event, you know.
I mean, that's a warning sign, I think.
Yes, it is. And then, you know, the next major event that probably will happen will, at least in the United States or North America, will probably be on the West Coast. We'll see some changes there. So we're going to see, you know, these are spaced changes where they occur in events. So, you know, the West Coast, for example, gets broken up into three places over a period of months, perhaps even years. And then, you know, more things change. Where we're Louisiana now, that whole area, the Mississippi becomes like a huge, you know, almost like an inland sea.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
We have water just pouring down from the Great Lakes, into the Gulf, and so we expand that tremendously.
Can you imagine what that bridge will have to look like?
We're a very clever society. We can build things and that are unbelievable. And in the future, I have seen that kind of technology. You know, I've seen bridges that are just, you know, I look at them in the vision. I say, how did they ever do that? You know, we're talking about massive, long bridges, you know, bridging, you know, the eastern United States to the western United States.
With the future map, Gordon Michael, Cuba is gone.
Yes.
Half of Florida is gone.
Yes.
It's kind of frightening. This onslaught of water when it comes in, and we talked about whether it's gradual and the warning signs. Will it come in, though, in the form of tsunamis and higher tidal waves, or does it just like creep open like water did in New Orleans, where it just broke through the levee and just started rushing in, and it starts coming in that way?
The latter part, though it's different around the planet how it occurs, but the mechanism that is going to drive all this is the landmass. Both ocean and land are going to buckle. In other words, land is going to get displaced. So you're going to have portions of the seabed that are going to break the ocean level. It'll be new land, particularly in the eastern, off of the Florida coast of the east, for example, between here and Africa. Very large mass of land will rise there. And same thing in the Pacific, between the Hawaiian Islands and the west coast of America, you'll see a large land mass. So you've got land masses being displaced, some rising, some sinking. The ratio of 75-25, you know, water to land remains the same. But it's this movement of land thrusting up that then in turn pushes water, and then as melting occurs, as we find a new axis position and we have more solar direction on the poles, we get more melt off, and therefore we drive more water. Now, you know, everybody wants to know, when is this going to happen? And the late great Edgar Cayce, as you mentioned, and people like Ruth Montgomery and myself, we all saw this happening around the turn of the century. So back in 79, before I knew who Cayce was, or any of these things, was you know, I kept seeing the millennium image of a millennium party, so I knew it was around 2000. So we all saw that date, and it didn't happen, so we were all wrong. So one of the lessons that I learned is that we can see an event, but something may modify that event. And events usually do happen. That's been my experience. And so it's just, where in the timeline does it happen? And when you see visions, it's really hard to get a date unless you happen to, your vision includes a newspaper, for example, or a license plate and I look for those little elements. Otherwise,
in your visions.
Yeah, you look for it and you say, okay, this is going to happen. You know, with Hurricane Andrew, when I predicted that right on the money, all of it, because I actually saw a vision of the newspaper. So I just reported what the newspaper said, and it occurred. The same thing with the Northridge quake. Those are events that I saw clearly because I was able to see some element. I trained myself to look for these elements. And, you know, there's also this wild card, which is human consciousness. What play does that, you know, take into consideration here? I think it's probably significant. But either case, we were wrong on the dates, yet we're still seeing it unfolding. So whether it occurs, you know, 5 years later or 10 years later, the events still appear to happen, and they happen slowly but abruptly at the same time. So it's abrupt. A kind of a calming, and then another, and then another, and another.
Now, when you talk about those dates, though, of course, you have to talk about, as you do, the Mayan calendar date of 2012. There's got to be some tremendous significance to that year.
There is. You know, the calendar itself, as it was deciphered, and it's a more relatively recent thing. It's not something that we've had for a long time period of knowing what it's meant. But researchers, you know, have come up and decoded their language, their alphabet, and their ages. And the fascinating thing is that their calendar goes back a long ways, you know, thousands of years back, and then it stops abruptly at this time period. And so the calendar shows these different ages where, you know, the Earth was disrupted by either water or fire. You know, there's different elements, and it kind of shows that. And so it's kind of amazing. And one of the interesting things that I found when I started researching this is that the material or the data seems to come from another place before them, from survivors from an ancient society that is only known in myth now as Atlantis. But there seems to be a correlation between that. And so, mm-hmm. you know, my sense is that during that time period, if you believe in the possibilities that civilization is much older than we think it is, and that in the past we had a very highly advanced civilization, that maybe they were able to either time travel and see things, or they're able to tell certain conditions that would set up changes. And I think that's where the calendar kind of got in. And it is kind of eerie, you know. But I also need to say that these events may not happen in 2012. I mean, they could happen tomorrow. Or they can happen later than that. It's a window, and that I think these changes will really start to move.
Now you're talking about the map changes or the pole shift?
The map changes and the pole shift, which are one and the same.
I mean, because as we well know, we are getting this polar shift. We've now got 7 years to go before 2012. That's not impossible. Shift by that time.
Again, you have to look at the changes that are going on with the magnetic field. I think that's very important. And also the things that are going on with the sun. And if we look at these things, you know, we see that something clearly is accelerating. You know, to have the magnetic field moving so quickly. And I also believe that a lot of this, the beaching of cestaceans, you know, I think that can all be tracked to magnetic instabilities and temperature. I think these are things that are causing a lot of these beachings. It's all part of this mechanism of change.
All these incredible skyscrapers and structures that are in some of these bigger coastal cities that'll be underwater, will they be sticking up where you could see part of them in the ocean, some of these tall buildings in LA, for example, or will they all be submerged?
Kind of like Planet of the Apes and movies like that where you see it. I haven't seen those kind of visions that show that. I mean, I have seen visions that showed a place in Los Angeles, and I saw the sign Los Angeles, so I knew it was Los Angeles. And what I saw is streets filled with looks like crystals. I mean, it was just glittering. The sun was hitting, and it was glittering, and they were probably three stories high of this stuff. And what it was is glass, just. Blown out of all these skyscraper windows, just filling the streets with glass. So, you know, the amount of dropping. For example, in California, you know, when the first wave, there's three fractures that I see on the West Coast occurring, and the first fracture kind of creates a series of islands. They're about 100. After the second quake. You know, the second fracture where it actually kind of falls off into the sea.
Yeah.
Kind of that runs from like Eugene, Oregon, you know, all the way down to Phoenix. That's like the second one. And the third one pushes it all the way into Colorado. But each of these things, you know, create islands. In other places, it just sinks. So, you know, my guess is that with the exception of about 150 islands on the West Coast, most of it will be underwater. And you wouldn't even see those kind of structures.
What happens to Hawaii, way out there in the Pacific?
Well, landmass, there's a huge landmass. You know, landmass is going to be, you know, bigger than Texas. That's going to rise up there, but slowly rise, not quickly, but, you know, over a period of a year, it'll break the surface. And that displaces a lot of water. So the Hawaiians, of course, are very active volcanic islands, and so you can imagine that anytime you move water around, you're going to create tsunamis. And so, you know, the high portions of the islands are good, but, you know, we're going to lose quite a few of them. The main island of Hawaii and portions of Maui, Oahu, you know, there's going to be portions of the higher grounds that will remain. So they don't all go underwater. They lose a good portion of it.
Now, you were saying that we're also going to have land masses pop up while some of this land mass is being inundated by water. Could that be Atlantis? There's been talk that Atlantis will rise again.
I think two areas in the east, between we'll see South Carolina region down to all the way down to the Keys, for example. If you look at that, draw a line between those places and then eastward out towards Africa, you're going to see a large landmass there that's going to rise. I believe it's already been rising. I've been there. I've dived on the area. I found some of the, like a lot of others, I found ancient structures there. So that whole section is going to rise, and that is really the one of the last major islands of Atlantis. Atlantis originally was one huge landmass that spanned from, you know, up here, probably Virginia, we'll say, all the way down to Cuba. I mean, if you look at it, that kind of length,
right,
that was originally Atlantis and all the way almost to the Easter Islands on the eastern portion.
And how far east out was it? All that far then?
Yeah. It was massive, and then through a series of earth changes over 70,000 years, it went through various stages, and at least the visions that I saw, more like a movie, just watching it occur, was that it seemed like it kind of broke, and there was like two major islands, and then three, and then there were five islands, and then finally there was only one island left. And that island that was left is the one that is known in myth as Poseidia or Poseidon.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the landmass that I see rising as we speak. I mean, it's just steadily rising. So we're going to see that there. And then we'll, you know, underwater archaeology is very time sensitive and very expensive.
Right.
So, you know, we're going to find out more about our heritage and the fact that earth changes are not new to this planet.
Will we develop the land masses when they come up?
We will. I don't think it will happen quickly, because I think when a lot of these land masses come up, there's going to be other problems to deal with on that landmass. But I think eventually they will. But I don't think we're going to see it necessarily in the first half of the 21st century. You know, half of it, we might start to see some development. But much different development than we would know today.
Michael, if this happens by 2012, will this structure of your future map support 300 million Americans?
The landmass that we have here would not. I mean, we could, but you know, we would have to assume that the population growth that we have now was going to continue, and you know, in nature, whenever there is any kind of change, you don't have the same growth. And you also have loss of people. So we're going to see a lot smaller numbers, and we're going to see more ruralized kind of communities.
What are we talking? 150 million people left?
I don't know those numbers. I just know that it will be a substantial reduction, but I don't really have enough. I've never been shown a number. I just know that when I see communities, they're much different than communities of today. They're more, you don't see power lines, and you don't see, and it doesn't mean that they don't have technology, but you don't see power lines in cars like we see it in factories. It's different. It's entirely different. And so I'm assuming they're much smaller communities, which mean a much smaller population.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. Talk about what has happened worldwide then with this map in terms of the United States being a superpower. What happens? I mean, does that begin to get relegated to China, for example? Do we still have our strength, our defense? We'll be back in a moment with our guest, Gordon Michael Scallion. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with our special guest, Gordon Michael Scallion. We'll have him direct you a little bit more to his matrixinstitute.com, tell you a little bit more about that, too. This is fascinating material. And I shall be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Gordon Michael, will we have enough time to get some of the people out from these areas that are going to be deluged with water, or will it be too late for them?
I think New Orleans is a really good example of what happens when, when things happen, even with warning. Because there's different reasons why people did not get out. There isn't a singular reason. You know, it's not a case of race, and it's not just a case of money. There's a whole series of reasons, and they could probably be broken down to four or five categories. So those same conditions are going to occur. You know, when there's warning signs, people will stay into the last minute. There isn't a week that goes by that we don't get hundreds, literally, of letters asking if people, if we could tell people, you know, give them at least 2 or 3 days notice. You know, we don't have that kind of information, but I understand where they're coming from. Their whole life is there, you know, their family is there, everything is there. And what if it doesn't happen? What if the hurricane just doesn't come ashore here? You know, what if the earthquake stops? What if it happens someplace else? All the what ifs. So, unfortunately, I don't think that the majority of them will get out. I think we're going to see, some staggering numbers, and that's just the way it is. You know, as people become more aware, you know, I think what happens is, and one of the reasons that they came out with a map is so there could be a pictorial, so when things start happening, people get a better sense of it. And a lot of people have taken the map and abused it to, you know, they were going to make a move in their life anyways. And this was kind of like a focal point. Say, well, since I'm going to move anyways, I'm going to choose to move into some of these safer areas.
Got to tell you, I broadcast, as you know, Gordon Michael, most of the time in Los Angeles, some of the time in St. Louis. My family lives out here. Mm-hmm. So it's a great alternative for me to do 3 months, 1 month in. But I got to tell you, every time I leave Los Angeles, I get emails from people who say, you know something. You've been told something. You know that this is. And so, anyways, looking at your future of North America on the map, St. Louis stays intact. Los Angeles doesn't. I'll never be able to defeat these arguments now.
Yeah, it's a, the way of consciousness is that some people, you know, need to stay in critical areas. I mean, we saw this in and we're seeing it right now, of course, in Louisiana, where we're seeing portions of the police department, significant numbers, just leaving.
200.
And then we're seeing the majority of them, you know, staying, helping, doing heroic things, you know, really being of service to the community. So, you know, the changes bring out all of our fears, and it also brings out the best of us and the worst of us.
What does this do to the strength of the United States as a superpower?
If we were to move ahead, 20 years, we wouldn't really see superpowers per se. Because, you know, tonight we're focusing on North America because of the event that just occurred. But, you know, I also have a world map that shows you the changes in the world. So, you know, as we're going through changes, other countries are going through changes. This is not isolated to us. You know, it's not like the hand of God reached out and says,
we're not alone in this dilemma.
Right. So everybody is in a survival mode, you know, and then there will always be those who will try to take advantage, just like what's happening right now. So everybody kind of ratchets down several points. We do have the advantage, and we will have the advantage, is that one of the things that we do really well is produce food, especially grains. And that remains intact. And so we have the ability to even increase that significantly. And so we'll be doing a lot of exporting tremendous amounts to other countries who will have nothing. And so, you know, and what they do have, it almost becomes like a barter system, you know, and instead of trading dollars, they're going to be trading, you know, commodities. And so we're going to see a, you know, more of a coming together of a planet. You know, I wish that none of these things would happen, but at the same time, they are happening. And you know, by looking ahead, and I have, you know, 30, 40 years, I see a, you know, kind of a world reborn in a whole different philosophy, a major shift in consciousness, you know, a positive world.
What about our ability to go into space, plans to go to Mars? Does all that continue in the future, or does that change as well?
That changes. You know, the trend, you know, will be more robotic, and you know, that will continue. But a major breakthrough, and it's not just optics, but it would be akin to a telescope. The kind of images that you see with Hubble, imagine that from Earth, regardless of what the atmosphere is like, images like that. Imagine images that we would see with a telescope of the moon that we could see of the surface of planets, not only in this solar system, but even others. And it's a fantastic science fiction kind of a vision I saw, but it clearly happened after these changes, and I'm not sure that it hasn't already been developed.
I was going to say, are there people in power, Gordon Michael, who have looked at your future map, have looked at some of the things Edgar Cayce has predicted, has maybe looked at some of the things Nostradamus has talked about? Do you think they're reacting to this? Do you think they're doing things, building tunnels or homes or underground facilities in the areas clearly marked as dry land? Or do you think they simply go, oh, come on now?
It's probably the latter. You know, I've only had, you know, I know other futures have had experiences with military types, and I've only had one in all my years, but it was enough to get my attention, and that was when I released an article on a series of visions I had when all the UFO craze was really big in the 80s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. It was really huge, and I did an article about a Delta flying craft that I saw. Three different types, and I described, you know, what powered them, how they were powered, where they went, and boy, you know, 24 hours after that thing was mailed on a Friday, I remember, and I think it was Monday night, I get a call from someone, and I'm thinking it's a crank at first, but they. You know, I later learned that it wasn't. I mean, I had confirmation it wasn't. Just saying that it would be best if I focused more on environmental changes rather than craft, you know, military craft.
You must have been right on.
I hit a thing, and of course now we kind of, you know, it's been targeted as the Aurora project, but that's the only thing I've ever had. I've never had any. Buddy try to censor me or try to say, you know, here we are. But as far as underground, you know, capacity, I have no doubt that any government would do anything to keep its secret, and they would have survival places. You know, I have no doubt that in Washington, besides the you know, what we know of there, that there's other things in other places and other states. I have no doubt that there are such facilities in case of, and originally, of course, they were in case of the Cold War nuclear threat. So those were built, but I think that a lot of those have been converted to other reasons. You know, technology-wise, what secret that we don't know about is perhaps 50 years ahead of the marketplace? I mean, okay. I really think it's at least 50 years ahead, which means that, you know, fossil fuel-free vehicles and transportation systems, all that has been invented. I mean, I think I know we have
absolutely
it.
Right. Yeah, we have the capability of doing it if we wanted to. So you're a futurist, but do you ever look back into the past as well? Do you look back at, the Egyptians? I know you've done some work on the pyramids before. Do you take a look at that?
I normally don't. The way it works with me is that if I go someplace, an example is, and I cover this in my book, I had a series of visions showing me Egypt, the Sphinx, and just pictures along the Nile. And it went on for the longest time period, every night. And then finally, after about, I don't know if it was a couple of weeks or 3 weeks of every night seeing these visions, I woke up one morning and I said to Cynthia, I said, I think we need to go to Egypt. And she said, all right, let's go. and literally within, within a week, I think, we had tickets and a destination. We had a place in Cairo to stay. That was it. We had a hotel and we had transportation there. And when I got there, the dreams and the visions really started to fire off. And so, of course, when in Egypt, you want to go see the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. And I remember I went over to the Great Pyramid and, you get your ticket to go in. And I remember, going inside, and there's lots of people, standing in line to go inside this pyramid. And I went in, and there was a guide there, and he looks at me, and he says, and he waves me to come on, so I come on. And then he puts his hand up to stop the line behind me. And I'm thinking that because it's a narrow passage where you have to climb a long distance to get up to the king's chamber, and you almost have to hunch over to get up this long path. And if you're claustrophobic, you don't want to be in there. And so I just thought that. So I'm walking and I'm looking back and I don't see any people. So I said, well, maybe he just waits a while. So I get up and I'm in the king's chamber. There's nobody up in there. I'm the only one. And while I'm there, all of a sudden there was a flash of light. And everything I saw now was, just clear as vision as I was looking at anything. But instead of looking at the granite walls in the king's chamber, mm-hmm. I am now looking at the construction of the building itself. And that continued for what later found out about 20 minutes. And I never have a vision that long. Usually they're measured in seconds, and occasionally there might be a minute, but never this long. And no one came up. And so I turned around and I went back down and I looked at him and he smiled at me and he hugged me. And then the other people started going up. I have no idea what that was about. To this day, I have no idea why that happened. But I watched the construction and it answered so many questions of the why and the who. And, it was just this amazing thing. And more importantly, what it was used for, what was the purpose of it? It wasn't a tomb. That was the main thing that I walked away from.
Was it a power plant?
No, it was. It was a kind of like an observatory, but observatory with the same technology I was just talking about, being able to see the stars without having to go there. It was, I guess, if we had to identify it today, we would call it an out of body machine that allows you to literally go to other stars in your astral body and literally visit other places, other stars, when the time is right.
But did you have to be in the pyramid in order to do this?
Yes.
Okay.
And then there was a bunch of machinery inside of it that had to be tuned. So it's all stripped out of there now. But the instrumentation and the great lens that was there was a huge lens, probably the size of a Volkswagen. That's size-wise, but there was this massive lens that moved up and down this chamber, the ascending passageway.
What was that used for?
It was
to focus out or to focus in.
It was to do both. It was you tuned it, and it was able to tune using the Earth's vibrations. So the thing that powered it was not an external source, but it was the Earth itself. So the thing resonated to the Earth's vibration. That gave it its power. And then once that power was in it, the large crystal carriage would move up and down to tune or focus, again, when the time was right, when the alignments were correct between certain planets and stars and us. And once that was in alignment, then the priest and whoever the initiates would be at that time would be able to take these journeys. So you would literally journey in full consciousness to these other places. And so, you know, it would be akin to going to the finest university in the world and learning mind development. And this one temple allowed communications, and it also allowed an exchange of knowledge, and it also allowed people to ascend, if you will, go to a higher state of consciousness. So it was kind of like a final exam for students around the world who were ready to see if they were ready to take the journey. And that would prove that you were ready. You'd be a priest, and in which case you could then teach and do others.
All right, you saw the construction in your vision. How did they move those blocks?
There were several ways of doing it. They had airlifting devices. They kind of looked like blimps, if you will, but they again were longer. And so these things were quarried far away, and they were brought up underneath a carriage. I can see these huge balloons bringing them up, moving up the Nile. So they weren't by barges, but they'd come up, and then these things that would hover, and they would literally lower them into place. So it wasn't a case of ramps or slaves, but that was one way of getting them from the quarry. Now, once they were on the site, they used a levitation device, which basically was a instrument that imparted an incredible electrostatic charge to the finished block. So a 2-ton block, once it was, I'll call it ignited, once it was tapped with a rod, it was called a rod of light. Once it was tapped, electrostatic field would levitate it a few inches off the ground, and then literally a child could just move it, just push it, and they could push it up into place. And there they did have ramps to just move it into the position. So it was never a case of lots of people lifting things, more of the logistics of getting the stones from the quarry there and getting the stones moved in position and placed in position.
Were they Egyptians who built the pyramid, or was there some extraterrestrial help here?
There was extra help, but that help had been here before. I mean, they had come from before. It was consciousness was much different at that time. There were several people on the planet at that time that really came from the stars, took physical form, but were aware of all their incarnations, not only on Earth, but other places. So they were highly developed, and there were several of them at that time. And they worked. So the Atlanteans had developed the technology and to do all this. And then the Egyptians, along with other cultures, provided the labor force to produce it. So it would be today kind of like a small United Nations working on a project, a dam project. So it was a massive project that provided economic stability for the area, and it was no different than building Nostradamus or any great temple or any great church where the community would get involved. So it was built under, it was built as a spiritual temple. But at that time, nature and technology were intertwined. They never saw the difference between the two of them.
So right, and somehow we lost it.
We did, but we're getting it back. We are getting it back. And, you know, I believe in cycles. I believe cycles repeat themselves, and I believe the cycles are governed by the stars and the planets. How we play out those cycles is very unique to us. That's where the free will comes in. But the cycles are coming again, and so most of us here today were there then at some time. And Atlantis existed over a long time period, measured in hundreds of thousands of years. So, you know, a lot of us came back, and a lot of us are going to repeat, and a lot of us will bring that old technology back and the belief systems and the society systems. All those cycles, I believe, will come back here in the next decade. It'll start in the next decade in earnest.
Our guest is Gordon Michael Scallion. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take phone calls next. His website is linked up with his name at coasttocoastam.com. But for those of you who might not be on your computer right now, it's matrixinstitute.com, okay? Matrixinstitute.com. His fascinating book, which he wrote several years ago, is called Notes from the Cosmos. But go to his website, look at this, some of the things that Gordon Michael is doing. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more of consciousness. We'll talk about John Titor, the time traveler. Does Gordon Michael believe in time travel? And we'll take your calls.